Welcome to Crossroads. The United States is expanding its missile defense systems in countries around China. Now, this is taking place as the newly revised nuclear defense strategy in the U.S. is shifting from recognizing Russia as the main nuclear threat to this country to now saying the Chinese Communist Party is the main nuclear threat. And while the United States has now released additional sanctions on Chinese companies, you know, for the support of Russia and its war on Ukraine, the Chinese Communist Party is doubling down on its military ties and its challenges to the West. Now, first on this new missile defense system. Now, Defense News said this. They said the Air Force is making progress on preparing a network of dispersed bases and airfields across the Pacific in case of a war against China, the service's top general said Wednesday, but must do more to defend those bases against attack. Now, it notes the Air Force fears that if a conflict breaks out in the Pacific, China could send barrages of missiles against the United States' larger, more traditional regional bases in Japan and Guam. It notes that such attacks could seriously degrade or knock out the Air Force's ability to launch aircraft in the Pacific. And so to counter that, the U.S. Air Force has developed Agile Combat Employment, or what they call ACE, which would spread out air operations to a variety of smaller operating locations in the region. And note that some of those ACE locations could be located in civilian airports or austere bases set up in fields with rough airfields, and they would be run by smaller teams of what they call multi-capable airmen trained to do several jobs like fueling aircraft or providing security instead of just one specialty. Now, this is important. Remember, this is in addition to the new hellscape strategy that the U.S. is working on to defend Taiwan in the event of an attack by the Chinese Communist Party. Basically, like a drone swarm program. You'd have airborne drones, you'd have surface drones, you know, ships basically, and you'd have undersea drones, like basic kind of semi-submersibles or submersibles, but of course run autonomously. And the idea is, of course, to have just these autonomous systems swarming the area in mass numbers and being able to destroy Chinese ships and so on in order to deter them or hold them off long enough for the main military assets of the U.S. to get there. Now, the idea of having pop-up military bases, and notably troops trained in multiple skills, instead of just having one guy in charge of security and one guy in charge of refueling, right? Instead of having one specialty job, having them multitask, basically. Now, that also includes something very important because this is meant to counter something the Chinese Communist Party has been talking about in its wartime plans were an actual conflict to take place with the United States. The Chinese Communist Party has what's called the Assassin's Mace program. And the Assassin's Mace is the program the CCP would use were an actual war between China and the United States to take place. And what it aims to do is essentially knock out the key enabling systems that allow the U.S. military to fight. Knocking out our satellites, knocking out the electronic systems with, you know, an EMP or electromagnetic pulse attack. Using things like microwave weapons to target U.S. troops. Things of that sort. But one thing the CCP has actually laid out as part of the Assassin's Mace program, and in the event, again, of a surprise attack against the U.S. or its allies, is they would knock out the airfields. Now, if the United States only has a few airfields within an operating range of, you know, a rapid CCP invasion of Taiwan or something of that sort, this means, of course, that the United States would not be able to launch its air assets. Part of the Chinese thinking with this is that you just destroy the airfield, you kill the main operating staff so that some of the key functions necessary for the fielding of air assets just cannot be done. Through a few targeted attacks, you basically render an airfield inoperable. And so rather than having to fight all the U.S. jets, which they can't really do on a large scale, you make it so that we can't field the jets in the first place. What it seems that the U.S. is doing with this strategy is it's kind of getting ahead of that. So rather than having a few airfields that just run all the operations, they have dispersed operations and the ability to set up rapidly new ones in different locations. And also kind of hardening our ability to have it so they can't kill a few targeted people and then just destroy our ability to field jets and so on, they're going to be having airmen who are trained in multiple tasks. So that, again, it's more of a dispersed, decentralized ability that is harder for the CCP to knock out. Now, this also falls in line, notably, with the recent congressional assessment, saying that if a war were to break out with the Chinese Communist Party right now, the United States, at least they claim, would lose. And one of the reasons for that is, well, we've kind of offloaded a lot of our manufacturing. We don't have good resources to get rare earth minerals. We don't have access to things that we would need to basically keep our military running, and also to get, of course, the ammunition and assets we would need to replace things as the war drags on. One thing it recommended was that the United States also expand its alliance with other countries. And now with Japan, the Philippines, Taiwan, India, Australia, other countries in that region, it seems the U.S. is focusing a lot more heavily on expanding its operations with other countries. Now, the strategy that's being rolled out now also aligns with what appears to be a new focus for America's nuclear defense strategy, which, as I mentioned, for the first time has shifted its primary focus from Russia to a primary focus on the Chinese Communist Party as the main nuclear threat. And remember that if you shift your focus from Russia to China, you know, on the concern of the global nuclear war, that's not just something you say just in passing and kind of don't change anything. What this means is that the U.S. will now have to start expanding its missile defense systems around China. And that means, of course, having good enough relationships with countries around China to let us do that. And so with Japan, for instance, the U.S. will probably start expanding its nuclear defense systems. With the Philippines, for instance, maybe with Taiwan, although that'd be a pretty risky move with the CCP. Maybe even South Korea, where the U.S. had previously deployed its THAAD systems, or was going to, but because of pressure from the CCP against South Korea, they backed off of it. And also, more importantly, within the Arctic region, they're now planning to launch new operations to field missile defense systems. Now, with that being said, it appears the United States is especially deepening its ties with Australia, not just on the military front, not just on the maritime front, not even on, you know, for example, expanding its bases there, but also on the economic front and on something important, which is the supply chains. Now, I mentioned that one of the key problems the U.S. has in terms of maintaining a long war against China and maybe Russia and a few other countries were to take place is that we don't have access to rare earth minerals. In terms of the materials needed for manufacturing, let alone the manufacturing industries themselves, we're too reliant on the Chinese Communist Party. They're now recognizing this, and they're looking to establish new mining operations to break reliance on China. And Australia's going to play a big role with that, including notably on new mining projects for rare earth minerals, and also notably making Australia the new launch pad for military defenses against the Chinese Communist Party. In fact, Washington Post said this. They said, deep in the outback of Australia, of course, a flurry of construction by Australia and the United States is transforming this once quiet military installation into a potential launch pad in case of conflict with China. You know, it's that runways are being expanded and strengthened to accommodate the Allies' biggest airplanes, including American B-52 bombers. A pair of massive fuel depots is rising side by side to supply U.S. and Australian fighter jets, and two earth-covered bunkers have been built for U.S. munitions. But the activity at this location, less than 2,000 miles from the emerging flashpoints of the South China Sea, is not unique. Across Australia, decades-old facilities, many built by the United States during World War II, are being dusted off or upgraded amid growing fears of another global conflict. Now remember, this is not the United States' first push into the Asia-Pacific region. During World War II, the United States was fighting two main wars, essentially. We were fighting Nazi Germany and its many allies in North Africa and Italy and elsewhere within the European theater. And we were also fighting the Japanese in the Pacific theater. During the time, again, when the United States was fighting in the Pacific theater, it had established pretty large military bases in Australia. because Australia was kind of far enough from a lot of the conflict that it was a safe zone, far enough away from the possibility of Japan launching kamikaze jets or other operations to destroy them. The same thing would very likely happen with China were war to break out. Yes, we'd have military bases in Japan, but those are in reach of Chinese missiles. Yes, we'd have bases in other areas. Those are within range, possibly, of Chinese missiles. And so Australia would be far enough from the actual war, were it to happen, that, of course, we could use it as the base of operations for that war, were it again to happen. Now, this is in addition, notably, to the rotating patrols of U.S. bombers the U.S. is going to be having going to Australia just on an ongoing basis now. And in addition as well to the rare earth mining operations Australia itself is going to be doing with other countries to help break the CCP's monopoly on these key materials. Australia is notably going to Qatar. It's going, for example, to Vietnam. It's going to other countries. And Australia, where again, one of the main economic, you know, industries is mining, they have the ability to do this. And interesting, it's not just Australia. The United States is looking to make moves in other regions to combat CCP influence. We'll be talking more about this after we come back from a quick break.
Experts agree one of the best ways to protect against financial uncertainty is to diversify your portfolio. Learn how physical gold and silver can secure your retirement funds from today's economic challenges with a gold IRA from American Hartford Gold. You can safeguard your wealth with no penalties or taxes when you transfer your current qualifying retirement accounts. Call now and our precious metals specialists will send you a free information kit, no cost or obligation. American Hartford Gold, a trusted industry leader with an A-plus from the Better Business Bureau, has a 5-star rating from thousands of happy clients. Whether you are getting physical precious metals in a gold IRA or delivered to your doorstep, we offer only the highest quality gold and silver. For your peace of mind, we also offer a no-fee buyback commitment, a low-price guarantee, along with free shipping and free insurance. So, don't wait. Call the number on your screen today and secure your financial future.
Welcome back. The United States is now declaring that China, the Chinese Communist Party, is the main nuclear threat against the world. And it's also expanding its missile defense systems in countries around China as a way to deter that threat. This is taking place also as the newly revised nuclear defense strategy has shifted from recognizing Russia as the main one and now saying the CCP is the main focus. And as this happens, notably, it appears the United States is especially deepening its ties with Australia, including with new mining projects for rare earth minerals, and also as a launch pad for military defenses against the CCP. And it's not just Australia. There's also the Philippines. Now, the Philippines is in an interesting position. They're not part of the Quad Alliance between the U.S., Japan, India, and Australia, but they're getting pulled into this kind of defensive pact that's forming against the CCP. Japan, especially, is working with the Philippines more directly, as is the United States. Japan is also working notably with Taiwan more directly. And even Vietnam is getting involved with some of these, although not so much with the United States. But now also something interesting is happening with the Philippines. The U.S. military is offering to escort Philippine ships. CBS said this. They said the U.S. military is open to the possibility of escorting Philippine ships in the disputed South China Sea, depending on consultations under the Allies' 1951 Mutual Defense Treaty. The head of U.S. Indo-Pacific Command said Tuesday, amid a spike in hostilities between Beijing and Manila, Philippines, in the disputed waters. Now, I mentioned before on the show the 1951 treaty, and this is important. Remember, the Chinese Communist Party, at the time where this first came up, the CCP was blocking Philippine ships from resupplying troops that they have stationed on a grounded ship they've been using as kind of a pop-up base in the South China Sea. And after some of the clashes with the Chinese Communist Party's coast guards, of course, you had Philippine troops getting injured in that. The CCP has coast guard ships. They have swords and axes and things like this. Now, the United States affirmed at the time that its 1951 Mutual Defense Treaty with the Philippines also extends to hostilities from a coast guard, not just an official military, meaning the Chinese Communist Party's hostilities using its Coast Guard for this, which is kind of a short of war tactic. Basically, what the CCB did was took military ships and then painted them as Coast Guard ships. And they say, this is not our Navy, this is our Coast Guard. And that means that, of course, they can justify what are actual military operations and claim they're just patrols or security operations being run by its Coast Guard, protecting Chinese fishing ships and things like that. Meaning they don't declare it as military operations, technically. The United States has clarified that regardless of how the CCB classifies it, those types of operations, even if they don't target, you know, Philippine military ships, even if they target Philippine fishing ships, that could trigger this treaty with the United States that the Philippines has. And that means that the United States has a commitment then to help secure the area. Now, what that means in practice is that that treaty could trigger the U.S. ability to basically launch full-scale military operations in the South China Sea and to begin protecting ships as the CCB tries to harass them, as the CCB tries to arrest, fishermen and others, and as the Chinese Communist Party tries to lay claim to that area. Meaning the United States would then have justification under an actual defense treaty to launch large-scale military operations in that region. Now, this is also significant because it highlights the rapid breakdown of an agreement that the Philippines just recently made with the Chinese Communist Party. They were trying to reduce tensions, right? That agreement broke down almost immediately because what it actually meant was that the Philippines had to alert China when they were going to go supply this grounded ship or alert China when they want to go travel through that region. The CCP was declaring that they are allowing them access, suggesting that the very agreement meant that Philippines was, unwittingly acknowledging the Chinese Communist Party's claims. The Philippines basically came back and said that, hey, that wasn't part of the deal. That's not what we agreed to. And so there was a miscommunication. That agreement then broke down immediately. And now the hostilities are back in play, and the United States may get involved directly now because of it. Now, in addition to this, Japan is becoming a major regional player in defense. And this is important because since World War II, Japan kind of demilitarized itself. Because of the CCP's hostilities, it has been ramping up tensions against Japan, and Japan has remilitarized itself. And interestingly, the conflicts between China and Japan are getting a lot more tense as well. Kyoto News said this. They say Japan's defense ministry on Monday confirmed for the first time that a plane belonging to the Chinese military violated Japanese airspace. And the latest development that could fuel tensions between the two countries following repeated maritime provocations by China. The Y-9 intelligence plane flew over waters in the Donjo Islands of the southwestern prefecture of Nagasaki in the East China Sea for about 2 minutes from 11:29 a.m., prompting the Air Self-Defense Force in Japan to scramble fighter jets, according to the ministry. Now, this is big, too, because remember, although Japan is, comparatively small, historically, they were one of the more powerful militaries in the world, going back a very long time. They have invaded, pretty much won wars with China historically. And of course, given their fighting prowess and their ability to have, high-tech systems, including things unattainable by the Chinese Communist Party, if Japan begins playing a much larger defensive role in alignment with the Philippines and Taiwan and the United States and Australia, that is a very powerful force and one strong enough that the CCP would have a very time breaking through it. Now, this is also in context, notably, where again the CCP is flying into Japanese airspace, of the Chinese Communist Party, remember just recently, flying jets and bombers alongside Russia into the United States air defense zone near Alaska. The CCP may be kind of overextending. It might be taking risks that it can't fully back up by doing this. Because although the CCP was doing this as a way to kind of, demonstrate its power and kind of demonstrate what is really just kind of belligerence, it is causing these countries to push back even more strongly. Notably, when the Chinese Communist Party itself is kind of in a weakened state because of its economic crisis. Now, because the CCP has now done this, it will likely spur Japan to increasingly push back against the CCP's military actions. And notably, Japan has been recently working very heavily on its defense programs with the Philippines and Taiwan and others. Japan is beginning to play a major role in this, as is Australia, notably with other local countries in the Asia-Pacific region, some of the smaller countries. And so you have defensive agreements being established, not even just directly through the United States, which is how it was for a very long time. But you now have Japan and Australia playing the role of regional defense leaders because of the CCP's aggressions. Now, we're actually seeing similar threats in other areas. Remember, the United States has now shifted its main focus on nuclear defense from Russia to China. And now, interestingly, the United States is also shifting its overall focus on the U.S. military from fighting terrorism and now focusing instead on the growing tensions with China and Russia. UPI said this. They said, President Joe Biden's recent approval of a major shift in U.S. nuclear weapons strategy highlights the attention of the country's national security officials are paying to Chinese ambitions for influence in the world. As changes emerge in the types of threats facing the United States, the American military adjusts its strategic focus, budgets, and planning. For instance, after 9/11, the attack on the Twin Towers, the U.S. military refocused away from its Cold War emphasis on preparing for a combat against a powerful nation like the Soviet Union and towards fighting small terrorist and insurgent groups instead. It notes that over the past decade, the Pentagon's efforts have shifted back to preparing for what officials call great power competition among the United States, Russia, and China. Now, this is despite the fact that global terror movements are again starting to resurge, especially because of the, Israel-Hamas war now taking place, which is also notably expanding to include Hezbollah, and also including, for example, the Houthis launching attacks in the Red Sea. Despite the fact that you have terror groups resurging, the United States is not shifting its focus to that. They're instead keeping the eye on the Chinese Communist Party as the main threat because it's recognized now the Chinese Communist Party's hand is what is enabling a lot of this. The terror resurgence, the CCP is heavily involved with Iran. It's heavily involved now with Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. The Chinese Communist Party is involved in different territorial regions that are playing roles, notably with even Hezbollah. And the CCP's involvement, notably with narco-terrorist organizations and the drug trade, a lot of terror money comes through drugs, also is within the CCP's kind of arena, so to speak. This means something else very important, though. It means that the United States is not falling into the trap the CCP had set up. We've discussed previously that Qin Kanrong, one of the main advisors to Xi Jinping, the head of the Chinese Communist Party, had declared previously the CCP's intent to start multiple wars. I said this before Russia-Ukraine. I said this before the resurgence of Iran. I said this notably in the documentary I made called The Final War. The Chinese Communist Party's plan, declared in the open, was to spark multiple regional wars and make it so the United States would divide its forces to focus on those. And that would allow the Chinese Communist Party an opening to do whatever it wants. Notably, first the invasion of Taiwan, and then very likely the establishing of a defensive ring throughout the East and South China Sea. Now, what is happening instead is as the CCP is sparking multiple wars, it's deemed now the main enabler of Russia's war in Ukraine. It's playing roles directly to keep the war going with Israel and Hamas, which is because of the ideological effect of it, causing terrorist groups to resurge, because again, it's a narrative war that is feeding a radicalization. The Chinese Communist Party is trying to spark conflicts, getting Venezuela possibly, maybe backing it up to invade Guyana. And the Chinese Communist Party notably is also starting many regional destabilizations throughout the South Asian region and countries around India. Now, what is interesting with all this is that the U.S. is not getting pulled into all those regions. It's supporting allies to push back against them, but it's keeping its eyes on the main issue, that the Chinese Communist Party is the main force behind it. And the U.S. focus is shifting and maintaining its focus on the Chinese Communist Party. Now, the CCP is also expanding its operations in other parts of the world. Now, there's the European theater with Ukraine. There's the Asia-Pacific theater with Taiwan and the South China Sea and the East China Sea. There's the CCP's military ambitions in the Arctic, which they're trying to militarize and trying to establish a trade route. There's the CCP's growing involvement with Brazil and Venezuela and Cuba and South America and Central America. And there's also its expanding influence, notably in Africa and also in South Asia, as I mentioned, where the Chinese Communist Party is trying to destabilize different countries and using debt traps to get countries into its pocket. The CCP, though, is also playing a role alongside the growing unrest in all those countries surrounding India, and that means putting pressure on India using those countries. Now, we've discussed the CCP's interests around conflicts in Bangladesh and Sri Lanka, both of which have been largely destabilized because of protests and other issues, and also now with Myanmar. The Chinese Communist Party appears to also have some involvement in the growing unrest, where notably you have a civil war taking place. Reuters said this. They said China's military said on Monday it had organized army units and joint air-ground police patrols near its border with Myanmar to maintain security and stability as fighting between Myanmar's ruling junta and rebel forces escalates. It says the patrols will focus on areas around Huili, Jiangkong, and other frontline sections in China, the military said in a statement. And it says that major fighting has occurred in northern Kachin and Shan states in Myanmar, with artillery shells injuring people and damaging property on the Chinese side, and also threatening infrastructure projects in China. It says the Southern Theater, the Chinese People's Liberation Army, is organizing army units to test troops' abilities to quickly move, block and control, and strike together and maintain security and stability in the border areas, the military said. Now, it's likely this is tied in with the Chinese Communist Party's new attempts to become a regional security force. That was something the Chinese Communist Party launched with its member states in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization just recently. And essentially, it looks like the Chinese Communist Party is trying to build a similar force to NATO, a regional security force that it can use as its kind of strong arm within the area, within the whole Eurasian region. It'll be more like a NATO with Chinese Communist Party characteristics, though. Whereas NATO looks to fight against, you know, terrorists or totalitarian, you know, leaders and so on, the CCP's focus is to kind of maintain the status quo within its own interests. And so the Chinese Communist Party would, for example, back anything that supports the interests of the Chinese Communist Party. Now, we've discussed also one of the main tools the CCP uses to expand its control in many countries in this area, one of the big ones being the Belt and Road Initiative. Because when countries can't pay back the CCP's predatory loans, right, they use debt traps, the CCP gains control over the infrastructure or other key assets. And as they, again, go deeper into debt with the CCP because of the way the interest rates are set up, because they're set up as debt traps, they're designed to be unpayable. They're designed so these countries cannot pay them off. That is the goal. Because what happens is the CCP then extends its control over the countries using debt as a way to subjugate them. And we're now seeing this in many of these countries. For example, in Bangladesh, in Sri Lanka, and now with Nepal. Economic Times said this. It said Nepal asks China to wipe away a loan it can't afford to pay back. And it says that when Nepal's new international airport opened last year in one of the country's biggest cities, it was the type of landmark project expected to elevate the fortunes of one of Asia's poorest countries while deepening its ties with China, which built and financed the project. But this airport in Nepal has become a symbol of another sort. It says the pitfalls of China's international infrastructure projects, which face criticisms for sometimes costly and poor quality construction that leave borrower countries awash in debt. And now it's catching up with them. It says this, On Thursday, Nepal's one-month-old government, led by the country's largest communist party, formally asked China to convert a $216 million loan for the airport into a grant, wiping away the debt. And I'll tell you, the CCP probably isn't going to do it. The Chinese Communist Party's state-run companies in that area, it looks like they botched the airport project, including, notably, not even just on bad construction, but also by inflating the cost of the project, which also deepens the amount of debt. And also, interestingly, you know, near India and Pakistan, on the other side, the Chinese Communist Party is also facing other issues entirely. The CCP is dealing with militants in Balochistan that are targeting CCP-led projects with attacks. South China Morning Post said this. They said separatist militants attacked police stations, railway lines, and vehicles and highways in Pakistan's province of Balochistan. Balochistan is kind of an independent area. Pakistan claims ownership over it. You have separatists who are fighting back against Pakistan. But because the CCP has gotten involved in Balochistan because they want the port there, and they want it notably for this whole Belt and Road Initiative trying to make a trade corridor, the CCP is becoming a target of these, you know, Islamist militants. Now, notes, the attacks in this area killed at least 33 officials, according to officials on Monday, and the most widespread assault by ethnic insurgents in years. And notes that militants have fought a decades-long ethnic insurgency to demand the secession of the resource-laden southwestern province, which is home to a number of major China-led projects, including a strategic port and a gold and copper mine. It knows as well that a rail line between Pakistan and Iran, a railway bridge linking Quetta and the provincial capital to the rest of the country, were also hit with explosives in militant attacks, railway official Mohammed Kashif said. Now, this is important because the CCP is kind of in an odd position in Pakistan. The whole Balochistan region claims it's independent and has a long-standing conflict with Pakistan because of this. The militant groups there, right? They're not just fighting Pakistan, they're also now fighting the Chinese Communist Party. But the CCP is in a funny position because it doesn't want to get involved in the security operations fighting an insurgent group because they don't want to become involved in like an anti-terror war. They're asking Pakistan to basically do the fighting. Pakistan can't do it. And so the CCP's assets are getting targeted there and they are not really pushing back against it. And very likely this is because the Chinese Communist Party, it is set to lose a narrative war if it does that. Were the Chinese Communist Party to get involved in anti-terror operations, and although they do this to an extent, but they don't actually fight them, it would make the CCP possibly get pulled into an insurgency. And the Chinese Communist Party, notably, is one of the biggest abusers of Muslims. It uses Muslim Uyghurs for slave labor in China. It uses them for its cotton fields. It uses them for other types of, you know, enslavement in different industries. The Chinese Communist Party persecutes them. It harvests their organs, as they do against other groups like Falun Gong and even some house Christians. And the Chinese Communist Party, because of that, is on the verge of being deemed one of the main hostile countries against Islam, as, again, you have different countries pushing back and looking at, for example, what Israel and Hamas are up to. The Chinese Communist Party could, in terms of the narrative war, be in a similar position to Israel, where it's seen as kind of the focus of this global jihad. The CCP and its involvement in this area is kind of caught between that right now. They're not properly defending it because they don't want to get pulled in, but they might have to start defending against this if they want to maintain a presence in that area. And so they're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place, especially, notably, they're facing similar issues in Kazakhstan and other areas as they're trying to build railway projects. They want to be this new security force, but they don't want what comes along with it. Well, everyone, that's all for today. Thank you for joining us. Let me know what you think in the comments. Also, please help share this episode. It helps get the word out. And as always, please take care of yourself, stay informed, and stay free. Thank you.